From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, it's The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, is the era of big podcasting upon us? Then a documentary about the infamous soccer player Diego Maradona. His exploits on the field were widely celebrated and recorded. Off the field was a different story.
Half of the footage we found outside of Naples. Then we realized there's more. So then we had to figure out who's got it. We found out that Diego Maradona's ex-wife had it in a trunk in their apartment in Buenos Aires.
Gabby Moreno sings for immigrants on her new album. And we bid farewell to opera great Jesse Norman. All that coming up on The Frame. In Hollywood, it's all blockbusters all the time. And with so many superheroes and sequels and spin-offs and prequels, it's really hard for original stories to get told. Now, could that same mentality be shaping the future of podcasting? Nick Kwa is the founder of the podcasting newsletter Hot Pod. He just wrote an article for Vulture called "We're Entering the Era of Big Podcasting." Nick, welcome to the show.
How's it going?
Before we get to the future of podcasting, let's take a step back. What were the transformative moments in terms of the growth of podcasting?
You could generally break up the timeline around two turning points. At first, you had this sort of very long sort of evolution and creeping sort of growth period. That's like 2003, 2004. And the sort of the 10 years after that point, it was just, you know, various, you know, bloggers, trying out podcasting and various sort of technology writers and creators. At some point, Apple stepped into the frame and decided to integrate podcasting as part of the offerings that they distribute over their iTunes platform. And that sort of immediately created a market. And then you also had sort of a generation of creators who saw this new medium and decided to, you know, to try it out. It was a very low risk, high experimentation environment. And, you know, things kind of turned in 2014 when a combination of two things happened. One is Apple finally spun out the podcast app as its own experience on the iPhone, and it began to bundle the app by default. So it's just like, it's this door that opened for a bunch of new audiences that previously did not know about podcasts. The other thing that happened was Serial. Arguably the medium's first cultural phenomenon and massive hit. And the combination of two things kind of just, you know, it was lightning that struck twice that sort of blended together to cause a moment.
Let's talk numbers for a second. The music streaming site Spotify has spent more than $400 million buying the podcast company Gimlet and two podcast studios. And in a couple of years, podcast advertising is expected to surpass $1 billion a year. So how could those two things shape what's to come?
One, it positions Spotify as a very, very motivated actor in the podcast space. It wants to own the category. But the second thing that it did is, by spending that much money, it also validated the space. It put up a flag, and it sort of declared that this, you know, this mountain is valuable. They want a piece of it, and this in turn kind of raises the stakes for other sort of music, audio streaming platforms, but also drew the attention of countless other entertainment companies and conglomerates looking to podcasting now as a possible place for them to build projects, to invest in, and to hopefully someday make a ton of money out of.
There is an old joke about how to become a best-selling author, and that's have a best-selling book. Because when you have that, you have great shelf space, and people walk into a bookstore and they see your book. Could the same thing happen to podcasts, that the rich could get richer because they're getting all the promotion or shelf space at places like iTunes or Spotify?
One of the prevailing narratives about podcasting, up until this point, actually, even, is that money is kind of hard to come by. Like, you know, you can have sort of a hit, you know, true crime show, you can have a hit interview podcast, but there's sort of this prevailing narrative around podcasting that between the sort of crudeness of its analytics and the newness of its sort of, you know, of its place in the culture, advertising money isn't flowing in as quickly as, you know, podcast celebrities and successful podcasts hoped that it would be. And so where we are shifting towards, it seems that there is more appetite among not just advertisers, but investors to put money into the space and really sort of inject more revenues going to the pockets of podcast creators. But the flip side here is that, you know, the further capitalization of the space also raises the possibility that we might see the death of its middle class origins. Because, you know, money is now becoming sort of an organizing principle more so than it was, there's this notion that, like, if you were a publisher or a media company that's investing in a podcast, you want to de-risk it. You're likely to sort of invest in people who already have hits before, or like a celebrity who already has a proven fan base. And that in of itself could lead to the general openness of the space to close up culturally and to sort of redictate the terms of podcasting such that it is yet another space that only the big survive and only the sort of well-known survive.
Well, I wonder if there's also some sort of comparison to what is happening, say, at Apple's App Store, where Apple apps are much more visible than others, or Amazon, where Amazon's brands get promoted over everything else. Could that happen? Is it already happening if, say, iTunes is not as neutral in the future as it has been in the past?
That is one of the other great anxieties here, that the platforms will end up being the primary dictator of, you know, the flow and green lighting of projects moving forward. And sort of, you're right, there's a corollary here with the larger digital media landscape that we've seen, in which platforms are in a position to pick winners and losers. The real flashpoint here is this report that Bloomberg put out a couple of weeks ago that suggested that Apple is looking into maybe funding original podcasts that may or may not be exclusive to its platform. And so this would be, in turn, sort of a matching up against what Spotify has done, which is acquire podcast studios, and they're beginning to build out sort of a division that produces Spotify originals, which may or may not be exclusive to the platform. But there is a possible and somewhat probable future in which both Spotify and Apple and whatever other major platform pops up begins to fund exclusives, and this becomes a war not unlike the streaming wars we're seeing with television. And that is in opposition to what is sort of the ideological root of podcasting, which is his blogging heritage, the sense that anybody can listen, anybody can publish, and in turn, anybody can build their own sort of platform, their own voice to reach many, many people that they otherwise could not have reached previously.
Nick Kwa is the founder of the podcasting newsletter Hot Pod and a contributing writer at Vulture. Nick, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Coming up next on The Frame, a documentary about Diego Maradona, who was larger than life both on and off the soccer pitch. Diego Maradona was not tall, about 5.5 feet, and not particularly trim, but he was unstoppable on the soccer field and is widely considered one of the greatest players of all time. Maradona was born in the slums of Argentina, and in many ways, he was unprepared for the fame and fortune that came his way. A new documentary called Diego Maradona follows his life and soccer career with all its ups and downs. It was directed by Asif Kapadia. His previous films were about the singer Amy Winehouse and the race car driver Ayrton Senna.
Are you okay holding your own mic? Here's what I would recommend.
I met with Kapadia at the Telluride Film Festival, where his movie had its U.S. premiere.
I want to ask you, first of all, about if you think there's a way to define where the Maradona film follows and how it follows Senna and Amy.
It follows them, I guess, because stylistically and kind of aesthetically, they're done in a similar way. They're documentaries made about kind of single characters, entirely using archive. In this case, I was able to meet Diego Maradona, so that's the difference. I didn't meet Amy Winehouse or Ayrton Senna. They're kind of all child geniuses. They're all absolutely fantastically brilliant at something. And it's the idea of understanding the journey of what happened to them when they became successful and achieved their dreams and what comes with that achievement.
So Diego Maradona was not only an incredible soccer player, but he came out of the slums. He was not well educated. Even though he was incredibly talented, he was thrown into a world where he really didn't know how to manage that talent or manage his own life. And that seems to be almost like what the entire documentary is kind of focused on.
Maybe in the US, fewer people know who Diego Maradona is. Around the world, he's pretty huge. He's an incredibly famous person. And really, for the last 30 years, he's been this Maradona, this kind of legend, this myth, this guy who hangs out with Fidel Castro, does some crazy things, you know, fires guns at journalists. He's got not particularly a great reputation. He's been obese. He's got a drug habit. So I guess the idea of the film was to show, well, how did he become that person? And all of the films, the thing they have in common is, you know, why did Amy Winehouse end up the way she did? And to understand, she wasn't always like that. She was an amazing person. Same with Senna. People may not know much about him. They knew the ending in a lot of places in the world.
When you try to define what was his gift as a soccer player, how would you describe it?
The really interesting thing about Diego Maradona is he is from a really poor, tough place. He's from the street. And he is a street guy. And on the pitch and off the pitch, he works and lives and rolls like a street person. So he's got a really unusual body shape. You know, he doesn't even look like an athlete yet. And because of that, he's really small. He's only 5'5". He has a really low center of gravity. Messi's similar and came after. But Messi is of the era of football where you can't touch anyone. They fall over, they get a penalty or free kick. Maradona's from old school football when people try and break your legs, and actually did break his ankle, you know. So he had incredible vision, he did, on the pitch. He could see everything that's going on while running really fast with the ball literally stuck to his foot.
Maradona's probably best known to a lot of people as playing for Argentina, but the period in this film is largely set in Naples, when he's playing for Naples, and there's a sports journalist who says in your film, Maradona in Naples was the story of his life. How does Naples come to get him? Because that's an important transition, important transfer in his life. And the city of Naples itself is also very important in this story.
Absolutely. City of Napoli is a character in this movie. It's like the main thing that kind of needs Maradona. He needs them because he's at a low point. He's this kid from the age of 16. Everyone said he's going to be the best player in the world. They're already comparing him to Pele. And he hasn't done anything yet. And really, he went to Barcelona with all his hope. He goes there. He has an awful time. He gets treated pretty badly. He gets injured. He gets ill. He goes out at night. He doesn't train. He doesn't focus. And he's kind of famously, no one tells Diego Maradona what to do, even at a very young age. So he goes to Naples, essentially because they're the only team that will buy him. But Naples, are the poorest city probably in Europe, probably the highest kind of murder rate and crime rate in Europe and high up there in the world. Massive kind of Camorra gang warfare going on at the time. They've never won anything. And they get the most expensive player in the world. Naples is full of streetwise characters, and Diego finds his element. He finds the city that he's made for, really.
And he does incredibly well with the team, and he brings the team up to the championship.
Yeah, the only time they've won. You know, they've never won before, and they've never won since. So that's why he becomes elevated as the godlike character.
We're talking with Asif Kapadia about his new documentary, Diego Maradona. People who are supporters of England would remember, probably very unfortunately, the hand of God goal in the 1986 World Cup.
Poor clearance, Maradona with Shilton. Looked like handball, that. Maradona celebrating, and the goal's going to be given.
But what people forget in that game is the other goal he scored, which is considered one of the greatest goals in the history of professional soccer. And I think it's in the film that to love and hate and to know Diego Maradona is to see those two goals and you know everything about him.
Yeah, in a way, you know, football, there's a saying in England, you know, it's a game of two halves. And so the film is about the two sides of Diego in many ways. It's about the beauty and it's about the cheat. You know, he's a genius, he's a devil. And so the whole thing about him is this character that's got these two sides to him, and you need one to have the other. You can't basically separate him. You know, you've got this guy who's a really loving, friendly guy, a really, really lovely sense of humor, but he's got an incredible darkness to his personality as well. And so, yeah, the idea of that match, you know, really, he's achieved a lot in his career, but that game against England is the reason why he's loved and hated.
There is obviously tremendous amounts of footage of Diego Maradona playing football, or as we call it in the States,
soccer. Go on, do it. It's called football.
But there's also archival footage that you have in this film that makes the movie. How did you come upon this footage? Who collected it, and where did you find it in the process of making this documentary?
Somebody got in touch with me saying there is this footage out there that we have got potentially access to, filmed by two Argentinian cameramen who were hired by Diego Maradona's agent in 1981 when he was really young. And this guy thought, Maradona's going to be a star, so I'm going to film it. So he starts filming him with two cameramen who follow him from Buenos Aires through Barcelona, They go to Naples, on the pitch, off the pitch. They're in the car when he's traveling. They're the guys filming him arriving at the Napoli stadium, that amazing footage when he's, you know, walking into the Colosseum. The cameraman got fired, never got paid probably, went off with the tapes. 1 hour outside of Naples, there's this guy with a room full of U-matic, this old video format from the 80s, U-matic tapes of Maradona that have never been seen before.
How many hours?
Hundreds of hours. You know, my producer kind of went through it and he came up with the number 500, but it could be, you know, 700. Half of the footage we found outside of Naples. Then we realized there's more. It wasn't all there. So then we had to figure out who's got it. And we found out that Diego Maradona's ex-wife had it in a trunk in their apartment in Buenos Aires. So there are shots in the film where he gets out of a car, and the reverse shot we found on the other side of the world in Buenos Aires.
So what does that give you as a filmmaker if you're trying to reveal some version of a Maradona that's not known?
I would say that the answer in these films with Senna, Amy, and with Maradona is I love to kind of study them. When I'm doing the research, I'm looking at their eyes, I'm looking at their hair, their face shape, their body shape. I'm trying to guess, what year is this? What period of the life? When are they happy? When are they smiling? When does the light go from their eyes? What happened? Something's gone wrong. They're lying. And you can see what their tells are. And so for me, what the footage gives you is the opportunity, and the way all of my films have been made is to just stay in the present at that particular moment in time and to follow the characters and to see their faces. And really, the audience can just understand the story by looking at them, because you're seeing the real kind of unfettered version of them. This isn't material that was shot, even though the idea was to make a movie. It's not the kind of social media of now where people go back and look at their phone and say, I don't like the way my face looks, delete. This was shot and forgotten about. So it's 30 years old, 35 years old footage, some of it. And you're looking at it and you're going, he's ignoring the camera. So there's a naturalism to him, even though he's one of the most famous people. So that's what I'm trying to do, is trying to get a naturalism to the characters, to show the story, and then to give you the context through the voices and the interviews that I do to understand what's going on.
People who I think know Maradona have this image, and it's a visual image in their mind, of him as overweight, struggling with addiction. And yet there's a period when he's playing in Naples where he is as fit as any athlete on the field.
He was the best. There's no denying it. What he would say is, just imagine how good I could have been if I had trained like everyone else, you know, if it had kind of that level of professionalism. But that wasn't him. I mean, that's the important thing about this film. A lot of people know the ending. They know he became obese and he had a cocaine problem and various other things. What I'm interested in is the journey of where were they before. You know, the version of Diego Maradona you've not seen or you don't know about, that's not on Twitter or on Instagram, but actually the soccer player when he was at his key, at his prime years, when he became the best player in the world, what he achieved. Even though he has a massive, you know, presence and an ego, he was an incredible team player. And he took a not a great Argentina team and they won the World Cup. And he took a very ordinary Napoli team and beat the strongest teams in Europe and the world at the time, which were the Northern Italian teams, the richest teams in the world at the time.
There's footage toward the end of the movie about Maradona, very present day, and it's difficult to watch, to see what has become of him. When you were thinking about how you wanted to end the movie and what Maradona might take away from the film, what was it that you were focusing on?
I mean, it's a real challenge because one of the reasons for doing the film was it was very different to Senna and Amy. They tragically died very young. I've spoken to a lot of people, a lot of biographers and writers and people who spent time with him, saying the minute you press send to the publisher, or the minute you send, you know, this is the film that I've made about him, something will happen tomorrow where it just turns your whole movie upside down. So my aim was to try and make a film that deals with him, but also gives you the essence of his life and his journey and hints at who he became later. When you think of Diego Maradona, you don't think of someone who looks a bit lonely and a bit lost, but actually you realize a lot of these athletes, a lot of people who become famous, in the end, I think he just wanted to be home with his mum. You know, he's a lost child, but he covers that up with all the machismo, you know, being controversial and being angry and doing things. But actually, underneath it, he's still a kid.
Has he seen it?
Not yet. We've tried. I met him about 5 or 6 times when he was living in Dubai. That's where I did the interviews. And as we were completing the film, I tried to go to show it to him. And that's just when his team, or he decided to leave Dubai and start traveling the world. And he was at the World Cup. And I thought, that's not a good time to show you this film. Then he moved to Mexico and he was coaching in Sinaloa. And he's only just come back to Buenos Aires. So in the next couple of weeks, I'm planning to go to Buenos Aires to show it to him.
Asif Kapadia's new documentary is called Diego Maradona. Asif, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you. Great to be on here.
The documentary Diego Maradona debuts tonight on HBO. Up next on The Frame, the new album from Gabby Moreno, and we bid farewell to Jesse Norman. When Gabby Moreno came to the United States from Guatemala in her late teens, she wanted to make American indie music. Now she combines traditional Latin music with pop sensibilities. And for her latest album, she teamed up with famed producer Van Dyke Parks. Her record is called Spangled. It's out on October 4th and includes an updated version of David Rutter's 1998 song, The Immigrants. It was recorded to support efforts to reunite families at the border.
I always tell people now that I feel like an angelteca. I've been living in Los Angeles for 18 years. That's half of my life. But I'm still not a citizen. I'm still just a U.S. resident. Can I feel part of both? Is that so bad? You know? My name is Gabby Moreno. And I was born and raised in Guatemala City, and I came to the United States when I was 19. I love singing songs from Latin America, whether it's from Guatemala or Mexico or Peru or Argentina. And it felt good for me to be introducing this kind of music to an American audience. I met Van Dyke Parks, and we started talking about music from Latin America, and he told me how much he loved it and he felt a strong connection with it. And so we said, well, it would be great to do a little project where we bring in songs from different countries of Latin America as well as songs from the United States and try to bridge the two hemispheres. We don't want to build a wall. So much trouble in the home of the brave and the land of the NYPD. And he was the one who brought to my attention the song The Immigrants. Am I an immigrant or am I a new slave made for old brutality? So the song originally was written in 1998 by David Rutter for a Haitian refugee who was severely beaten by New York City police. And now we decided to change the lyrics to make it more relevant for the whole nation and not just New York City. So much trouble in the home of the brave and the land of the free. We had this song ready to go, but we had no idea that it would be so relevant right now, especially with what we're seeing right now, that they're being separated, kids from their parents. It's like, what is this? What have we become? Is it that man has lost his reason? I think it's an important song to let everybody know that I think we all should be speaking up. We are doing something amazing and we're not going anywhere. You know, we've always been here and you better get with it. The immigrants are here to stay
to help build America. And now we bid farewell to the great singer Jesse Norman, who died on Monday. Norman, of course, was a world-renowned opera star, having graced stages around the globe. But she had a wide range of musical interests, including spirituals, as you're hearing now. And she was an adventurous artist. She once performed in a production that featured music by John Cage and was directed by avant-gardist Yuval Sharon.
The San Francisco Symphony asked me to direct John Cage, the pieces from his songbooks, and they had already engaged three really incredible soloists, Joan LaBarbera, Meredith Monk, and Jesse Norman. And I first thought, well, Jesse Norman doing John Cage, that's amazing. That's a real coup in so many ways. I mean, this is going to be so different from the kind of things that we associate with Jesse Norman. It wasn't Wagner. It wasn't Strauss. It was this very intimate, private kind of performance that John Cage wanted for the songbooks. Of course, she is so well known for singing Wagner and Strauss and is known on the stages of the Met and the Salzburg Festival. But she also did these really experimental performances with Robert Wilson. She would do Stravinsky just as well as she would do Wagner. And that curiosity was absolutely what motivated her. And it made the entire process just such an unbelievable delight for all of us to see this incredible diva just bare soul to John Cage and devote herself very seriously to what John Cage was about with just as much rigor and just as much seriousness as she would an art song.
And Jesse Norman even performed pop and jazz standards, as heard on the album titled Roots, My Life, My Song.
My baby don't care for shows. My baby don't care for clothes. My baby just cares for me.
Jesse Norman died from complications tied to surgery she underwent in 2015. According to a family spokesperson, she was 74 years old. And that's it for today. I'm John Horn at the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. We're back here tomorrow.
Is something he can see.